Welcome to the deep dive. Today we're plunging into the Yazidi oral tradition.
Yes, and we're going to be looking at it through, well, the lens of late antiquity, based on Esther Spatz's research.
Right, and this isn't your typical dusty historical analysis, is it?
Not at all. Spetz's work, it's really grounded in dedicated fieldwork, actually among the Yazidi people of Iraqi Kurdistan.
Wow.
Yeah, just think about the effort, you know, documenting centuries of spoken tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And in a region facing considerable instability.
That really highlights the significance, yeah. These are traditions that were largely unknown in the West until this kind of investigation.
Pretty much.
So for you listening, our goal today, our mission, is really to unearth some remarkable connections. Connections between Yazidi beliefs and the religious world of late antiquity.
Which is roughly the 2nd to the 7th centuries AD.
Exactly. We're talking about how these ancient ideas have survived, how they've transformed within this this vibrant oral tradition. It's kind of a shortcut, hopefully, to understanding a really rich and often misunderstood religious heritage.
And it's important, I think, to understand the inherent challenges here. Studying Yazidi religion, well, its transmission is primarily oral.
Right, so not many early written sources.
Very few. And then you have the emergence of the Masefa Resh and the Jelwa, those sacred books in the late 19th century. That adds another layer of complexity.
Because their authenticity is questioned, yeah.
Highly questioned. Likely forgeries by outsiders, but they are still believed by many scholars, including Spate, to reflect some genuine Yazidi oral traditions. So they give us this debated but still valuable glimpse.
Okay. And this brings us to a really key point about oral traditions you mentioned. You said they're homeostatic. What does that actually mean?
Well, think of it like a living system. It maintains balance. It tends to shed memories or details that become irrelevant over time.
Okay, like forgetting old slang.
Sort of, yeah. Mm. But it also readily absorbs and adapts new elements, things it encounters from other traditions, even literate ones.
Ah, so it's dynamic. It changes, but also preserves.
Exactly. It's this process that makes them so resilient and also so fascinating, but tricky to study. It allows for, you know, potentially very old ideas to be preserved right alongside more recent influences.
Fascinating. So where do we start seeing these links to the ancient world in the Yazidi tradition?
Well, a natural starting point, I think, is Tawusi Melek, the peacock angel.
The central figure.
The most central, the most revered figure in Yazidi belief, yes.
And as we mentioned, even those contested books, the Masefa Resh and Jelwa,
right,
they describe a divine figure who is traditionally identified as Tawusi Melek, proclaiming, you know, absolute power, sovereignty, omnipotence.
Mm-hmm. He's paramount in the theological framework presented there.
Okay, so Spetz research is trying to trace elements like this back to late antiquity.
That's the aim, tracing elements within Yazidi religious thought back to that period.
Mm.
But of course, as she really emphasizes, pinpointing precise origins for every single detail. Well, in oral tradition, that's often impossible.
Right. You can't just find the first written mention easily.
Exactly. And the Syro-Mesopotamian region back then, late antiquity, it was just this incredible crossroads of religious and philosophical ideas.
Real melting pot.
Totally. You have potential influences from Gnosticism.
With its focus on secret knowledge, right?
Yes. And Manichaeism, that dualistic faith that spread incredibly widely. Then early Christianity in all its diverse forms, and Judaism with its own rich history.
And these groups weren't just existing side by side, were they? They were interacting.
Constantly interacting, borrowing, sometimes merging ideas in, well, really fascinating ways. It wasn't neat separate boxes.
So this interconnectedness is key.
Absolutely key. Spet, actually building on work by scholars like Jay Reeves, talks about this concept of Syro-Mesopotamian mosis.
Okay, what's that?
Think of it as a kind of shared regional pool, a shared language almost of mythological expressions, symbols, ways of thinking about the divine.
Mm.
Different religious groups in Syria, Mesopotamia, even parts of Iran, drew from this common pool during that period and later.
Ah, so it explains why we might see similar ideas pop up in different places.
Precisely. And within this shared landscape, we start to see potential echoes in Yazidi tradition. Let's take the kirk, for example.
The sacred garment.
Yes, the sacred garment in Yazidi belief. It's often associated with a luminous black crown or headdress, the kaf or tak.
And this kirk carries a lot of symbolic weight.
Oh, a significant weight. And here's where you see a really interesting parallel emerge. Spate connects the Yazidi kirk to the idea of a garment of light or a robe of glory.
which you find elsewhere.
Yes, you find this concept quite prominently in Jewish traditions, in Christian traditions, and especially in Gnostic traditions.
Now, what did it symbolize there?
Often it symbolized a high spiritual status, maybe the state before a fall from grace, or sometimes it was seen as a reward for the righteous after death or enlightenment.
So a symbol of spiritual elevation expressed through this shared image of a garment.
Exactly. It's how this fundamental concept found expression across diverse ancient faiths.
It's quite remarkable how widespread that motif was.
It really is.
Yeah.
For instance, Manichaeism, you know, with its big cosmic struggle between light and darkness,
yeah.
They actually viewed baptismal water as a kind of light world incarnate. Essentially, it was the garment of light for those who were baptized into the faith.
Oh, wow. And you see reflections in Yazidi hymns, too.
Yes. Spet points to Yazidi hymns, the keels, that describe God himself fashioning a luminous kirk. And there's this idea of the kirk serving as a kind of foundation, or perhaps vessel, for incarnate angels.
So it's deeply woven into their cosmology.
Very much so. And it's not just abstract symbolism either. Think about the fikirs, the Yazidi religious ascetics or mendicants.
Okay.
The black-dyed kirks they wear are seen as representing their deep adherence and commitment to the faith.
Mm.
It's a visible sign of their spiritual path.
Right, a tangible expression. So Spet argues the kirk is more than just clothing symbolism.
She emphasizes that, yes.
Mm.
It seems to be deeply linked to divine revelation itself, existing right alongside the sacred hymns, the keels, as a source or sign of truth.
So it suggests a significance that goes beyond metaphor, maybe indicating a core part of their spiritual understanding.
That seems to be the implication. She even brings in the hymn of the pearl.
Ah, that's a famous one, isn't it? Found in various traditions.
It is. A beautiful, complex poem from late antiquity. You find versions or influences in Christian contexts, Gnostic texts like the Acts of Thomas, and Manichaean literature, too.
And it uses the garment metaphor.
Powerfully. The garment represents the soul's heavenly origin or its potential salvation, achieved through gnosis, through enlightenment. It really highlights that shared symbolic language we were talking about.
The imagery must be quite potent.
Extremely. In some Gnostic traditions, encountering your divine alter ego, which sometimes appears as this glorious garment, and then reuniting with it, that was the moment of salvation.
A reunion with your true self, symbolized by the robe.
Exactly. And similarly, you find Manichaean hymns speaking of a living self, or a luminous nature, appearing as a divine counterpart, often at the moment of death.
And seeing these echoes around the Yazidi Kirke, it really makes you think about how these deep ancient ideas persisted, maybe transformed, but didn't disappear.
Precisely. It shows the staying power of these core symbolic ideas.
Okay, so moving from the garment, what about other themes? You mentioned awakening.
Yes, the theme of spiritual awakening. Spet analyzes a specific Yazidi hymn, the Beta Sindhi, which translates as the Song of the Commoner.
Okay.
And she places it very convincingly, I think, within a recognized late antique literary genre, the Call of Awakening.
The Call of Awakening. Right. I've heard of that. Common in Gnostic texts.
Very common there, but also in related traditions. It uses this central metaphor. Sleep represents spiritual ignorance, darkness, being trapped in the material world.
And awakening.
Awakening is spiritual conversion, enlightenment, remembering your true origin. The Beta Sindhi fits this pattern quite well. It's like a spiritual alarm clock.
A wake-up call for the soul.
Exactly. And it's interesting, the Yazidi hymn doesn't just use the sleep metaphor. It also brings in Sufi imagery.
Oh, like what?
Imagery of wine and divine intoxication. Not literal drunkenness, of course, but mystical ecstasy as another path to awakening, to achieving this heightened state of consciousness and understanding.
So a blending of influences there. The ancient call to awaken motif plus later Sufi symbolism.
It looks that way, yes. Huh. A great example of that homeostatic process, absorbing and integrating. The hymn also speaks of a call from without.
Meaning?
A call originating from heaven, sometimes specifically from the throne of God, urging the soul to wake up.
And what's the promise if you heed the call?
Redemption. Heavenly reward. And often this reward includes the granting of a headdress, specifically a crown.
A crown. That resonates, doesn't it? You hear about crowns in other traditions, too.
Absolutely. Spet draws parallels to Jewish and Christian traditions that promised a crown of light to the righteous, especially those who persevere in the contest of faith, who fight the good fight.
So shared imagery of reward for spiritual effort.
Yes. And she even notes that in Syriac Christian literature, crowning became a common metaphor for martyrdom.
Ah, the ultimate spiritual struggle and reward.
Exactly. And perhaps unsurprisingly by now, Manichaean texts also heavily use this imagery of awakening from sleep and the promise of rewards like light garments and crowns for the faithful elect.
It really is a recurring theme across the board. It highlights this common spiritual vocabulary in the ancient Near East.
It really does. These motifs just keep showing up, underscoring that interconnectedness.
Okay, so these recurring themes are fascinating. Now let's maybe shift focus to creation myths. Spet talks about the Yazidi story of Adam's creation, right? A specific version.
Yes. She delves into a version recounted by a figure named Fikir Haji. It details not just Adam's creation, but the unique origin of the Yazidi people themselves.
And how does that story go? What's the unique part?
Well, this myth describes the Yazidi race originating from something called the Sur. It's explained as the divine essence or substance of Angel Sheikh Sin.
One of the primary angels.
Yes. And this Sur was somehow lost by Adam when he was expelled from paradise. It fell to earth, and from this divine essence, the Yazidis were born, distinct from the rest of humanity created later from Adam and Eve.
Wow. So it establishes a unique, almost divine origin for the Yazidi people, separate from everyone else.
That's the core idea. And what's striking here, as Spet points out, is the parallel to a Gnostic concept.
Which is?
The idea of a spiritual elite, often called the seed of Seth.
Seth, Adam and Eve's third son.
Right. But some Gnostic groups believe they, the true Gnostics, were descended spiritually from Seth, who originated from a divine source, not just Adam and Eve like the rest of mankind, who were seen as more material, less spiritual.
How did they interpret that?
They often focus on the biblical phrase about Eve bearing Seth as another seed, interpret another to mean different in kind, divine, celestial, not just earthly.
Okay. So this ancient Gnostic idea of a divinely chosen lineage, you see echoes of that in the Yazidi origin myth about the Sur.
You certainly do. It's a very similar structure. A special group descended from a divine spark lost or implanted at the beginning, setting them apart.
And does this Seth idea appear elsewhere?
Oh, yes. Manichaean mythology also gives Seth a special status, contrasting his birth with Cain and Abel's. And Spet notes something interesting. The name Nama appears in this Yazidi origin myth.
Nama, does that ring a bell?
It might have Jewish or possibly Syriac Gnostic roots. It's like finding these little linguistic or mythological clues like fossils, hinting at older connections.
It's incredible how these threads weave through different groups. Did the people of Seth idea stick around?
It seems so. The concept of a distinct, spiritually superior group, tracing back to Seth, persisted in various medieval Middle Eastern heterodox groups. You even find echoes in the Ali Haq tradition, another related group, who have their own myth about Seth's miraculous creation.
So these origin stories really lasted.
They did. They served a powerful purpose in defining group identity.
And how do the Yazidis themselves interpret this lineage from the Sur?
Traditionally, it reinforces their sense of uniqueness. They see themselves as descended from Adam's original divine essence, making them, in their view, the house of tradition, distinct from and perhaps older or purer than other religions derived solely from the later Adam and Eve.
A powerful narrative for identity and heritage.
Very powerful.
Okay, let's look at one more example Spate brings up. The Yazidi tale of Abraham, it includes the birth of Prophet Ismail.
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
And it's another fascinating case because it clearly shares elements with Jewish and Islamic accounts of Abraham and Hagar and Ishmael, but it also diverges in really significant ways.
How so? And is it considered a core religious text?
Well, that's interesting, too. There's apparently some discussion among Yazidis about its status. Is it a sacred kule, a hymn with divine heavenly origins, or is it more of a general tale, a sirach, perhaps shared more broadly in Kurdish folklore?
That ambiguity itself is telling, isn't it? About how oral traditions work, blending things.
It really is. It speaks volumes about that fluidity, how traditions evolve and incorporate different strands.
So what happens in the Yazidi version of this story?
Okay, so in this telling, Hagar encounters not just angels, but specifically Kurdish merchants named Rajab, Shaban, and Ramadan, the names of Islamic holy months, interestingly.
Sure.
And the key event is the appearance of a divine figure at a spring. But this figure appears three times in three different forms.
Three forms? Like what?
First as an old man, then as a young man, and finally as a baby.
Oh, man, a young man, a baby. That sounds familiar somehow. Is that the link to late antiquity?
That's exactly where Spet draws the connection. This trimorphic appearance, the divine manifesting in three distinct forms, she links this strongly to late antique religious thought.
How was that common back then?
The idea of the divine appearing in multiple forms, sometimes specifically three, seems to have been quite prevalent. You find it in Gnostic traditions, some Christian writings, and even in what we might call popular or folk beliefs of the era.
So this ancient way of thinking about God or divine beings showing up in different guises reappears in this Yazidi tale.
That's the argument. It's seeing an old pattern resurface in a new narrative context.
Can you give other examples of this trimorphism?
Sure. Spitt mentions, for instance, the Nusairiya or Alawi belief that Ali, their central figure, appeared in three forms, child, young man, old man. And the challenge was for people to recognize his true divine essence through these changing appearances.
Interesting. Failure to recognize the divine in its different forms.
Right. She also brings up the Hellenistic philosophical concept of aeon, meaning eternal time or the age, which was sometimes depicted trimorphically, possibly influencing religious iconography.
So it was in the cultural air, so to speak.
It seems so. And it wasn't just limited to groups labeled Gnostic or heterodox. Trimorphy, or the idea of multiple appearances, shows up in early Christian writings too.
Really? Where?
Examples include the apocryphal Acts of Peter, where Peter sees Christ appearing simultaneously to him and as a child to Marcellus, or the life of St. Aburtius. And even, perhaps most famously, the legend of the Magi, the three wise men representing different ages or stages of life, encountering the divine child.
Okay, so it was a fairly widespread motif for depicting divine encounters.
It seems that way. Suggesting a common way of thinking about divine manifestation in the ancient world.
So the Yazidi tale of Ibrahim, while having its own unique elements, seems to be drawing on this much older, broader pattern for depicting the divine encounter at the spring.
That's the connection Spett makes, yes. It taps into this ancient repertoire of religious imagery.
Okay. Finally, does Spett touch on how these traditional myths with these potential Gnostic or Manichaean roots sit with Yazidis today?
Yes, she briefly mentions the dynamic, the potential tension between these ancient traditional narratives and, well, more contemporary ways of thinking, or perhaps the influence of the majority religions in the region.
Which is natural, right? Traditions evolve, interact.
It's a natural process. As societies change and interact more with different belief systems, traditional stories sometimes face new questions or interpretations. Spett gives the example of some Yazidis showing perhaps some ambivalence towards that origin myth. We discussed the one about Adam's soul or the Yazidi essence coming from Angel Sheikh Sinsur.
Why the ambivalence?
Likely because it diverges so sharply from mainstream Islamic or Christian creation accounts. So it highlights how traditions are continuously negotiated and reinterpreted in the present day.
Constantly being understood anew.
Mm.
So as we kind of wrap up this deep dive, let's just recap some of the key threads we've pulled on.
Okay. We've really seen the enduring presence of these late antique motifs woven into the fabric of Yazidi oral tradition. Things like the powerful symbolism of the garment of light reflected in the kirk.
Right, and the echo of that ancient call of awakening genre in the Beta Sindhi hymn.
Exactly. And then these unique Yazidi interpretations of fundamental creation myths about their own origins, about figures like Ibrahim and Ismail, which show these really remarkable parallels with Gnostic and Manichaean ideas about divine lineage and manifestation.
And what's significant for our listeners, for you, is recognizing how these ancient spiritual currents, these ways of thinking, haven't just vanished. They've persisted, they've adapted, they've found new expression over centuries.
Understanding these connections, I think, offers really invaluable insights. It lets us appreciate the true richness and, frankly, the complexity of Yazidi religion.
Yeah, it places it within that much broader historical tapestry of Middle Eastern religious thought. It reveals a really long and fascinating history that's often overlooked.
And it just underscores the incredible power and the resilience of oral traditions, doesn't it?
It really does.
They aren't just passive vessels carrying the past forward unchanged. They actively preserve, yes, but they also adapt, reinterpret, and reshape ancient ideas across huge stretches of time. It shows a remarkable capacity for cultural memory and innovation.
It's truly amazing. So this exploration into the Yazidi oral tradition, looking through that lens of late antiquity, maybe leaves us with a final thought for you, our listener.
Mm.
Well, just consider how many other cultural or religious traditions, ones that might seem totally unique on the surface, could actually hold these hidden echoes of the ancient world.
Like hidden layers of history within their stories and practices.
Exactly. Perhaps there are many more connections out there just waiting to be uncovered, inviting us to explore further this fascinating interconnectedness of human history, human belief across time and space.
Certainly makes you want to look closer.
It does. So we definitely encourage you to maybe ponder the rich tapestry of Yazidi culture a bit more and perhaps dive deeper into the incredibly vibrant and complex world of late antiquity religions.